This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Robert Fisk, is one of two Western journalists still living in Beirut. Most of his colleagues left the city within the year after the kidnapping of AP bureau chief Terry Anderson, who was a close friend of Fisk's. Fisk has covered 14 of the 15 years of Lebanese civil war for the British newspapers The Times and The Independent. He was in Beirut for the Israeli invasion, the massacre at the Sabra and Shatila Palestinian refugee camps, the withdrawal of the PLO, and the bombing of the U.S. Marine headquarters. In the past couple of weeks, he's watched the withdrawal of the Christian and Muslim militias. This dramatic change in Beirut is the result of a national reconciliation pact signed by Muslim and Christian legislators a year ago in the sortie resort of Taif. Robert Fisk's book, Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon, has just been published in the States. So last Friday, he flew out of Beirut for a trip to America. I asked him about the risks he's exposed himself to by living in West Beirut.
Well, very much the risks that many Lebanese people have been exposed to. You know, we tend to feel that hostages in Lebanon is a peculiarly Western affair, but it's not. There have been tens of thousands of Lebanese taken hostage over the past 14, 15 years. And indeed, there are thousands of Lebanese who have simply disappeared and hundreds who are still held hostage and known to be alive in various prisons in Lebanon, some controlled by Syria's militias, some by Israel's militias, who languish in conditions every bit as bad and in some cases worse than the Western hostages.
What's the closest call you've had in the past couple of years?
There was an attempted kidnapping in 84 before many of the other journalists left when a car... I was driving down a street called Madame Curie Street in West Beirut. I should explain that earlier that day, quite by chance, I'd been interviewing a young Lebanese Christian who'd been held hostage, and I was thinking as I drove down the street about my interview with him. And it was just after dark. It was about 7 in the evening. And a car came up behind me and put its headlights on high beam, a big, old, battered American limousine. And it obviously wanted to overtake, so I naturally put my foot on the brake and slowed slightly. And as he came level with me, the passenger door was thrown open, and a man with, I always remember he had wild flying hair, he pointed a Kalashnikov at my car and with his left arm pointed to the side of the road in ordering me to stop. And I remember I kept saying to myself, this is it, trying to shake myself out of the sort of quiet and comfortable life that I did have with my nice home in Beirut, saying, you know, this is the moment when I'm going to have to make a very serious decision. And I let his car get in front of mine and begin to pull in, and he thought I was pulling up. And there were other men with long hair, one of them I thought with a beard, but I can't be sure, in the back of the car. It was a green car. And as I got enough space, I looked on the left to try and go past the other side of him and pass him out. I put my foot on the accelerator. And it was through fear I did it, not through any kind of courage. Although doing that, I realized that I'd committed myself to trying to get away from him, which was in a way a comfort. And he chased me through the streets, I guess for 2 miles. And they were quite crowded. I was jumping in front of other cars with my car. I was trying to overtake and put cars between me and him. And eventually, I remember I thought that it was raining because I became covered in water and liquid, and I realized that at the time of year it couldn't be the case, and the window was shut. And only when I stopped the car 2 miles away near the hotel where many of the journalists were living, and I realized that the guy had disappeared, did I realize it was my own perspiration swamping me because I was so frightened, and because while I was driving away I was crashing into parked cars in my panic to escape from this guy. I suppose that's the nearest I've come, so far as I know, to being kidnapped, although on other occasions I have obviously seen men in cars in Beirut whom I have been troubled about.
There's an effort in Lebanon now to make Beirut part of a new militia-free zone. What's behind this effort? Would you explain it to us?
Well, it really began with the Taif Agreement, the agreement of Lebanese members of parliament under the auspices of Saudi Arabia, when they met at the Saudi town of Taif and decided that while they would try and keep the confessional structure of the original government, which was imposed by the French in 1943, they would make some changes to it. These changes effectively would mean that while the president would remain a Christian Maronite, he would have fewer powers. And while the prime minister would remain a Sunni Muslim, he would have more powers. In fact, what it did is it gave more political power to the Muslims, who are now in a majority in Lebanon, and less to the Christians, who are now in a minority in Lebanon. 40 or 50 years ago, the figures were the other way around, and the government made more more sense, or at least the structure of the government made more sense then. The second part of the Taif Agreement was that there would be an elected president who would be accepted internationally. There was a man called René Mouawad, who was savagely murdered about a week after he took office. And then after him, the election of another man, President Elias Hraoui, who is now the president of Lebanon. General Michel Aoun, the Christian army leader who was appointed an interim prime minister by a former president, Amin Gemayel, then refused to accept the Taif Agreement and refused to accept Hraoui's power. And it was the destruction of Aoun's power which was necessary to achieve the implementation of Taif, although there is one important factor that has to be brought in. Syria wanted Aoun's power destroyed. Syria has 40,000 troops in Lebanon. Syria backed the Taif Agreement and clearly believed that if a new government, which would of course be a pro-Syrian government, could be installed, Lebanon, or at least the capital city, would be a city, a country friendly towards Syria, would not be consorting in Syria's eyes with Syria's enemies, particularly with Israel. So the Syrians played a leading role in bringing about the Taif Agreement, and they played an even more leading role in getting rid of General Aoun with international acceptance. And their leading role, of course, was it was their guns and their aeroplanes that bombarded him out of the presidential palace.
So in the meantime, how much of the militias have actually been driven out?
The militias weren't driven out. They were persuaded to go, mainly because the Syrians threatened them if they didn't. In theory, militia power has disappeared from Beirut. For example, when I drove around the city as the militias were leaving, I could see trucks carrying the Shiite Muslim Amal militias' heavy ordnance out of the south of the city. I then crossed and drove through the deserted and ruined port area, and I could see the Christian phalangists driving truckloads of ammunition, much of it Jordanian, much of it Iraqi, some of it American, out of the eastern side of the city. So the ammunition left, the guns left, and in theory, so did the militia men. But the militias come from the people. They live in Beirut, and I don't believe for a moment that they didn't later return to the city without their heavy guns. And indeed, there's proof of it, because in the days that followed, even on a few days ago when I was in Beirut on Thursday and then again Friday morning, I saw a Mercedes full of men with pump-action shotguns, bearded men staring out the window as I drove on my way to the airport. At one checkpoint, which is meant to have been dismantled, there were no militiamen on it, but in a waste lot next to it, there was a Volvo car with three bearded men in. This is the unarmed or comparatively unarmed version of the militias still in being. Suspicion is still there, and so is danger.
With the militias leaving, or at least theoretically leaving, Beirut, are more people coming back to Beirut?
There's no sign of it yet, although what you do notice, for example, is that the courses at the American University in Beirut, one of the finest universities in the Middle East, have got back to normal structure. Students are returning from East Beirut, which they were too frightened to do before, to the campus, the main campus in West Beirut. You notice a lot of things like shops reopening, people repainting gas stations. There are plans to reopen and rebuild the wreckage of the old Commodore Hotel, which used to be a press headquarters in Beirut. You see it as well in new nightclubs, new restaurants are opening, and also, of course, in higher prices. There are clear signs of a city that's being reborn, but, as I said before, I'll wait to see if all those gunmen really disappear before I believe this is a new, safe Beirut, heading back towards the security that it seemed to have before 1975.
Robert Fisk is my guest, and he's one of two foreign journalists still living in Beirut. He's been covering Lebanon for the past 14 years. He writes for the British paper The Independent, and he's written a new book called Pity the Nation. How is the Gulf crisis affecting life in Beirut?
In a Lebanese sense, quite profitably at the moment, and for a country that prides itself on being 10% men, I suppose that's only natural. One of the things that has happened remarkably is there's been an enormous transit of US dollar bills through Beirut. The reason for this is quite simple. When Iraq invaded Kuwait, it reduced the value and, in fact, effectively wiped out the existence of the Kuwaiti dinar. The speed with which this happened and the huge millions of dollars in savings that were wiped out overnight by the devaluation and disappearance of this currency made many Gulf Arabs from other Gulf states, the Emirates, Oman, and particularly Saudi Arabia, immediately lose their trust in their own local currencies, currencies like the Saudi rial. The actual value of those currencies was not reduced on the markets, but people in those countries immediately began to convert their local currencies into US dollars, which they knew would not disappear. And the Lebanese, being entrepreneurs and businessmen, immediately began to funnel currency through Beirut, taking, of course, the usual 10% check off it. And making money into the progress. Politically, there's a much darker scene. There's no doubt that the huge number of Palestinians in the city of Sidon, which is only 12 to 15 miles south of Beirut, have very much taken the Iraqi side. The PLO basically controls the camps there. There are 15,000 armed Palestinian guerrillas, most of them loyal to the PLO. So the streets there are plastered with Saddam Hussein portraits, which is not, of course, the case in Beirut, where it's President Assad of Syria whose picture is on the streets, alongside those of various Lebanese martyrs, as they call themselves. In northern Lebanon, the Iraqi Ba'ath Party, which has always existed there, has certainly grown stronger. And there has been a certain amount, not so much as has been stated in newspapers, but a certain amount of sanctions busting by people sending powdered milk and some foodstuffs across from Lebanon through Syria and then smuggled across the Syrian-Iraqi border.
Now, Syria has 40,000 soldiers in Lebanon now, and Syria is an opponent of Iraq. So how is that playing out now in terms of the Gulf crisis?
Well, for the moment, Syria is very satisfied with the situation in Beirut vis-a-vis the Gulf crisis, because you have to remember that Saddam Hussein's principal ally inside Lebanon was none other than General Michel Aoun. It was Aoun who was the only Lebanese leader who used to attend Iraqi Embassy National Day and Ba'ath Party anniversaries at the embassy in East Beirut. It was Aoun who received most of his ammunition last year, ordnance which he fired with artillery at the Syrians. Most of that ordnance came from Iraq, which the Iraqis publicly announced that they sent to him. Indeed, ships carrying Iraqi anti-aircraft missiles, Iraqi 155mm shells, arrived regularly in Aoun's enclave. So his destruction, Aoun's effective destruction on October 13, was a victory of Syria over Iraq. There are those people, many people in Lebanon, who believe that America, despite denials to the contrary, effectively gave Syria a green light to get rid of Aoun. Because in America's eyes, here was a man who in miniature also, to some extent, represented the Iraqi leader. General Aoun resisted all international efforts to get him to lay down his guns and accept the legal authority of Lebanon, i.e. President Elias Hrawi. He refused, even under economic blockade, to give up. There's an obvious parallel with Iraq. He was a man who openly boasted of his own links with Iraq. And I think there must have been a feeling in Washington as well that it would do Saddam Hussein good to see those television tapes of the shells bursting around the presidential palace, which drove Michel Aoun out of power. So at the moment, and one has to say at the moment because things change so quickly in Lebanon, President Assad is riding pretty high there in his hostility towards Iraq.
Since Syria does have 40,000 soldiers in Lebanon, can you maybe explain a little bit about of the background between Syria and Lebanon and what Syria is doing in Lebanon now?
Well, historically, the connection is undeniable. Until the French received the League of Nations mandate to control Syria after the First World War in 1920, what is now Lebanon was part of Syria. If I go into old bookshops near my home in West Beirut, for example, and pick up old coloured postcards of Beirut, it says Beirut, Syria, not Beirut, Lebanon, because Lebanon as a state then didn't exist. It was the French that carved out Lebanon and made Beirut its capital and handed over power in Lebanon to the Christian Maronites, who had always looked to Paris rather than Damascus in loyalty. It's always been said since by Syria's critics, of whom there are many, that Syria wanted to annex Lebanon to get it back. I'm not sure you can annex a country that was formerly part of your own country anyway, but I don't in fact think Syria wants that. It has not done to Lebanon in 14 years what Saddam Hussein has done to Kuwait in 3 months. It has not put its flag on the presidential palace. It has not destroyed the Lebanese government. In fact, it's tried to rebuild it. It has not introduced its currency into Lebanon. It has not introduced its political parties into Lebanon. But Syria is there with a very important political and strategic role in its own eyes. The first is it's frightened that Lebanon could be a back road for the Israelis to invade Syria, and it was very much consolidated in this opinion when the Israelis invaded Lebanon in 1982 and got as far, indeed further north than Beirut. And secondly, Syria itself is made up of a patchwork of different communities, much like Lebanon. And before President Assad took power, there was a good deal of discontent and fighting within Syria, much as there has been since in Lebanon. And I think Assad has always been fearful that the broken state of Lebanon, the fighting between the militias there, could spill over into Syria and reignite the old Syrian civil war. So those 40,000 troops are there to repress the violence that threatens Syria, to prevent a Syrian, to prevent an Israeli attack into Syria, and of course to make sure that Lebanon remains a pliant, friendly, pro-Syrian state, i.e. that the Lebanese will not have the independence that they would like.
If there is a fighting war in the Gulf, what do you think is going to happen in Lebanon? Do you think Lebanon would be a target? Do you think it would participate in the fighting?
Well, I think and I fear, and I hope there won't be a war, but I fear the result of a war would be that Americans would not be able to feel safe anywhere in the Middle East for months or years to come. And, of course, that would apply to Lebanon too. It would undoubtedly undermine the position of the very fragile new unity in Beirut. It would undermine the position of the Lebanese government. But you see, it would also undermine the position of the Jordanians, undermine the position of President Mubarak of Egypt. One of the things which I find living in Beirut and visiting the Gulf so much and spending so much time in Saudi Arabia is that things which are said in Washington, which make so much sense over here and which sound perfectly good sense to me when I'm here at the moment, for example, don't sound anything like as rational when you hear them in the Middle East. The distance, the different culture, the different religion means that in a way people out there receive the messages, receive the words, clearly no doubt, but with a completely different temperament and frame of mind.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, I'll give you a perfect example, I think. When President Bush sent his soldiers, when he made the decision to send American troops to Saudi Arabia on August 6th and 7th, he publicized what he was doing to the Arabs, promising them that Kuwait would be liberated, along the lines that America was a great liberator. This was the country which liberated Europe from the Nazis in 1944-45. And that, of course, is historically perfectly correct. And sitting here in the United States, I can see why he said it, and I can see that it's historically true. The Arabs, however, are not the slightest bit interested in who liberated Europe in 1944 and 45. In their eyes, America is not the liberator of Europe, it's the backer of Israel, and for the Arabs, Israel is their enemy. So the moment Mr. Bush sent troops to Saudi Arabia, while it may have looked logical here and while it may have been necessary for the Saudi government, it introduced immediately, because of the Israeli factor, a contradiction into what was happening.
Do you think that Israeli-Palestinian relations should be part of what's negotiated if there are negotiations between Iraq and the United States?
I think it's so easy to go back into retrospect, but I fear we tend to do it rather a lot out in the Middle East. Looking back now to President Bush's original statement, the reasons why he was sending American military forces to the Gulf, there were four basic reasons, of which the most important, of course, were security of the region with unconditional withdrawal of Iraq from Kuwait, the restoration of the legitimate Kuwaiti government, and protection of American lives. They were the four reasons. Looking back on it, I wonder if the Americans couldn't have been a little bolder than that, and whether they might have avoided a lot of the grief that Mr. Bush and Mr. Baker are going through now, if at that early stage they couldn't have said, look, we're talking about a new world order, and that's got to apply to all the Middle East, not just to Iraq and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, and that America now intends to use all its political pressure, its influence in the region, to solve all the injustices there, not just the injustice done to the Kuwaitis. If Mr. Bush could have done that, and he would, of course, have been linking the issue of the Palestinian question, he, one, would have got a lot more trust among ordinary Arabs, not just the leaders who say the things that Washington wants to hear, but he would also have taken away from Saddam Hussein the propaganda which he, Saddam, made when he made the linkage between the Palestinian question and the Kuwaiti invasion. In a way, by not having the ability or perhaps the courage to make that linkage themselves, the Americans gave the propaganda victory to the Iraqis.
What would you advise George Bush to do now with this January 15th deadline looming?
my God, Terry Gross, you're pushing me there.
Hang on. No, I'm just wondering, from your perspective, what you think.
Little humble British reporter tells the President of the United States what to do.
Well, you're not going to talk to him anyway, so it's all hypothetical.
Well, look, I'm afraid one of the problems in the Middle East is that the problems there are not just rooted in individual actions. They're rooted in history, in betrayals by the West, in broken promises, the Balfour Declaration, in broken promises by the British to Jews and Arabs alike, broken promises by the Americans. One of the things Mr. Bush has got to do before he makes any further declarations, I suspect, is decide whether America is going to be even-handed in the Middle East or not. Now, in very simple terms, for example, Mr. Bush is extremely rhetorical in his anger about the failure of Saddam Hussein to obey UN Security Council resolutions. Israel has many times failed to obey UN Security Council resolutions without finding 500,000 American troops turning up on its doorstep. Now, there is clearly here a message for the Arabs. America may wish to be an honest broker, it may wish to be neutral, but it does not act in a neutral way at the end of the day. One also has to take into account the fact that however much it may be denied in Washington, the Arabs have no doubt that the Americans are in the Middle East for basically economic reasons over oil. If Saudi Arabia was just a beach with a few nomads and a few camels, Americans would not be sending 500,000 men to defend it from Iraq and threatening to invade Iraq. So that's a starter. First of all, perhaps the American administration has to decide, is it going to be even-handed in the future, or is it going to allow itself to continue to be influenced by various lobbies there, the lobbies of rich Arab states, the lobbies perhaps of the Israelis? That's the first question that they're going to have to decide. And if they could decide it before going to war, it might save a lot of tragedy afterwards. In the short term, I'm afraid that at the end of the day, so many errors have been made in the preceding years and even the preceding months that it's difficult to see how the Americans can unlock all the doors which they've locked behind them. Mr. Saddam Hussein can do this easily because he runs a very vicious and savage police state. He rules through fear, and therefore he doesn't have to make excuses. He can invade Iran 1 year, withdraw his troops the next, call it a victory, and lose 1 million men. Mr. Bush can't do that because he lives and runs a democracy. And I think that one of the problems that's occurred since the beginning of this crisis is that the president and his advisors have found themselves constantly responding to what Iraq does, constantly making comments in response to what Saddam Hussein does. It doesn't produce anything. What it does is it makes more and more rhetorical statements of aim which were never intended in the first place. A good example of this is what happened in Lebanon in 82. The Americans came there with the same good intentions they've gone to the Gulf now. They started off with limited aims, the withdrawal of a foreign army or foreign armies from Lebanon, which is what the aim is in Kuwait. But suddenly, we had Mr. Reagan saying that the withdrawal of these armies and peace in Lebanon was essential to American interests throughout the Middle East. Now we started off with these four basic aims of the president, now President Bush in Kuwait, and within months, we've got huge rhetorical moral aims added to it. The potential destruction of Iraq, freedom from aggression, the end of a man who's claimed to be worse than Hitler, the American way of life is at stake. So what happened is, as the time has gone by, America has constantly widened and broadened the moral aims of why it's in Saudi Arabia, and thus locked itself into ever larger aspirations which it has to meet, and which I don't think it's going to be able to meet. One thing Mr. Bush could do is perhaps pull back a little bit on these moral aims and try and keep things carefully defined and refined down to the original aim of this business, which is to get Iraq out of Kuwait.
How much longer do you think you will continue to live in Beirut?
Well, every year or two, I tell myself it'll be the last one. I don't want to spend the rest of my life in Beirut. I certainly don't want to risk dying there for much longer. It depends. You know, it's a bit like following a huge drama, like reading a great book, like reading Tolstoy. After you get so wrapped into following the story and witnessing the events, you always have a feeling as a journalist of saying, well, I've seen all this and maybe I'd like to stay just to see what happens in the next chapter. And I guess over the years, that's what I've done so far. And I wouldn't want to make any promises that I don't want to see one more chapter.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been British journalist Robert Fisk, and he's the author of a new book about Lebanon called Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon.